Iku Iluna, please rise. Ea ka aha ho o kolo kolo ki iki I hana hano ua a koa koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Velina, makamoku puni o Oahu I ka moku o kona I anu ka ko ma alio lani hale. Greetings on the island of Oahu in the district of Kona. We are gathered here at alio lani hale. Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-25-0000525 in the matter of the tax appeal of PM and AM Research Inc. Petitioner Appellant Appellant versus State of Hawaii. Respondent Appellee Appellee. Arguing for Petitioner PM and AM Research Inc. Benjamin E. Lowenthal. Arguing for Respondent State of Hawaii. Michael Dunford. Also appearing is Joshua Michaels. Argument on the merits.
Aloha aina la and good afternoon. Today's afternoon is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. This hearing is being broadcast, and I'd like to welcome our substitute justice in this case, Judge Jordan Kimura. Counsel, ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right, thank you. The court has allowed 30 minutes for each side. Mr. Lowenthal, I understand you intend to argue for 20 minutes and reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Dunford, I understand you'll have 30 minutes with a 10-minute warning. So, Mr. Lowenthal, please proceed.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. Every year, the Department of Taxation determines how much Hawaii's people and businesses should fund the government by assessing and collecting taxes. Funding the government through individual assessments under the law is their goal. That's their mission. Taxpayers who disagree with the assessment have the right to challenge it. They can bring their challenge before a neutral, independent, and fair entity, depending on the type of tax, either the Board of Tax Assessors or, in this case, the Tax Appeal Court. It is what the taxpayers here tried to do. They brought their challenge to the Tax Appeal Court, but the TAC ruled that it lacked jurisdiction to review the assessment and dismiss the case, and then the taxpayers asked the ICA to review the jurisdictional question. That's where 23114 comes in. Subsection A says that the, quote, first appeal does not require the taxpayers to front the tax. They're entitled to an independent review of the assessment by an entity outside of the Department of Taxation. But once the TAC renders a decision on the merits of the challenge, the taxpayers have to pay the tax if they want further appellate review. DOTAX and the ICA want the words first appeal to mean any action filed in the TAC, regardless of whether the lower court reviewed the assessment or not. So when the Tax Appeal Court in this case dismissed the case before conducting the review, that, according to the ICA, is the first appeal. And respectfully, this interpretation should be rejected. The words first appeal in subsection A refer to the independent appellate review of the assessment, a review on the merits. And when the TAC dismissed the case for lack of jurisdiction, there was no appellate review. There was no first appeal of the assessment.
What do you point to, counsel, for first appeal meaning in a review on the merits? The words on the merits don't appear in the statute, right?
That is correct.
So what is your authority for us reading that into the statute?
I would turn the court to, I think a way of looking at it is whether this is ambiguous or not. I would submit that it is ambiguous because when we use the word appeal, or the common understanding, I should say, of the word appeal, it can take on two different meanings. There's this idea that appeal, and I should be very specific, when we talk about it as a noun, it could be shorthand for anything that's in an appellate court. You know, you can hear lawyers talk to each other, I have this appeal, or, you know, how'd your appeal go, that sort of thing. What we're saying in this case is that it is a much more specific meaning. It means the actual act of conducting the review.
I understand that's your argument. I'm
right.
Asking what authority do you point to support adding those kind of on the merit meaning
sure.
into that language?
I point to three things. First, I would look at the structure of the statute. You have subsection A and you have subsection C. Subsection C is the waiver requirement, or I should say the waiver allowance that allows the tax appeal court to waive prepayment. We believe, and it is our position, that the reason why the words first appeal means a decision on the merits is because if it is anything other than a decision on the merits, for example, in this case, a dismissal for lack of jurisdiction, then the tax appeal court does not have the jurisdiction to conduct a waiver proceeding under subsection C. The statute would fall apart. And the only way to really understand and ascertain the meaning of subsection A is to look at both of those subsections together. So that's one reason. The other authority would be the legislative history, which we outline in our petition. It seems to show that the legislature was deeply concerned about striking this balance between the state's need to collect revenue efficiently, time and time again every year to keep the government funded, and the rights of the taxpayer. And so they try to strike this balance by saying, well, your first shot at reviewing the assessment, you don't need to pay the tax, but everything after that, you do.
So, you know, on that point, what kind of comes to my mind is, if I know the issue is whether the appeal, the initial appeal or a request to review the assessment was timely, right? Because there was a dismissal for lack of jurisdiction and or the service, I get it, on the director. I think that was another reason for dismissing. But if the legislature's intent was to allow at least that first step without the taxpayer having to pay, what if somebody just really delays, files that first step late, and then you just continue to delay, though, if it's a lack of jurisdiction, and then they appeal it up to the ICA? Isn't that subject to kind of some abuse there?
I would say that in that scenario of a person simply trying to delay it by raising these challenges,
how do you avoid that under your reading?
I think to some degree it cannot be entirely avoided, to be frank with that. But I will say that it is a very narrow question as to whether the tax appeal court has jurisdiction. And it is not an issue that, it's not something that you can just raise on the merits. It should be a relatively quick form of review, not only by the tax appeal court, but again, by the ICA, once they have it in front of them. It's not necessarily an evidentiary hearing. It's not a review on the merits. It's simply whether the appeal has been perfected. And so my response to that would be, yes, these kind of appeals would have to happen, or these kind of matters would happen. Fortunately, it's an extremely narrow scope that should not take long to review when it comes to determining tax appeal court jurisdiction.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, you know, I'm trying to balance that with what you're saying the legislature's intent was with regards to the language of the statute.
And I appreciate that. I would say that the legislative intent in this case, while it's not entirely sparse, there's something there. And I think the spirit of it is to allow an honest, good faith review by an entity outside of the Department of Taxation, in this case, the Tax Appeals Court. Now, I understand that questions of jurisdiction and whether you even get to that assessment, that's always going to become an issue. But the applicability of this statute does appear to be designed for review on the merits. And that's what the legislator, when they were talking on the legislative floor, was obviously referring to. And that's how subsections A and C can work together.
Well, you know, I suppose over the years there's been taxpayer movements and taxpayer ways to sort of game the system. And sort of riffing off of what Justice Ginoza mentioned, I mean, you could have a devious taxpayer or get something out there, shoot something out there online and say, hey, folks, don't worry about this 30-day thing to file your notice of appeal. Just don't pay your taxes, wait 6 months, file it up there, let the case get dismissed, claim that the first appeal never happened, then you get more chance not to have your money taken yet, because you can appeal to the ICA. Yeah, maybe the ICA, you get a free shot there. And the legislature did intend this statute really to prevent delays for this. So I know you say it might be an outlier, but it might not be. So what would be your response?
In the concern for scoff laws, as you've described.
Yeah, manipulative devious types, maybe. Yeah, scoff laws.
I mean, you could also say that if a person were to do that, the tax situation is probably dwarfed by the potential criminal liability they're facing at that point. But I guess we must be very careful, or I would caution that we should not forget the people who truly are trying to get their assessment reviewed on the merits, which I would submit is closer to the taxpayers in this case.
Right.
They have issues regarding service, they have issues regarding timing, and there was no actual review for, frankly, several assessments here. And so my response, to put it concisely, or at least try to put it concisely, is we must not forget that there are genuine good faith taxpayers who are trying to get this assessment. And I do not believe we should be afraid of those who are going to try to game the system. There will always be people who are trying to be doing that. But at the same time, we must be mindful of the people who get caught in between.
I understand. Would your clients be eligible for the C waiver?
No. The C waiver is limited to income tax, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the monetary threshold. I think for some are below, some of these appeals are below, maybe one, but most of them are above the monetary threshold. And so even if the C waiver was applicable to this type of question, on these facts, they would not have the advantage of asking.
So that's why I wonder where your statutory construction by using C really fits into your A, we need a hearing on the merits versus the first appeal.
Well, I'm not saying that the C waiver is something that's going to cover every possible appeal, every possible assessment, but when looking at the words first appeal under subsection A, one can look at the waiver in subsection C to get a better understanding as to whether the legislature meant appellate review on the assessment or anything that is done in the tax appeal court. It is for that reason. I'm not saying that subsection C would apply to every review on the merits.
You know, would a prepayment waiver motion be collateral to the judgment?
We won't know in this case because the order and the judgment were filed, I believe, at the same time on the same day. There was no motion filed. Whether it's collateral or not, I would submit, is for another day.
I'm wondering if it's for today because they cite TSI International. What's your response to that case?
I think that when you attempt to apply the entire statute to a question of jurisdiction, the tax appeal court made it very clear that it felt it had no jurisdiction and dismissed the case, issued the judgment on the same day. I would believe that would be dispositive of this question as to whether it would be collateral or not. To say that subsection A would apply even to instances in which the lower court has declared there is no jurisdiction and therefore there is nothing left to be done and no other action can be taken, but then at the same time switch gears and say under subsection C there should have been this possibly evidentiary hearing in which the court has the power to hear evidence, make findings, and have a binding result, we would submit that as inconsistent.
I'm kind of confused why you believe that the waiver of 235-114C does not apply here.
I believe this is a GE assessment. The waiver under subsection C is limited to income tax, and even among the income tax assessments, I believe it's a threshold of $50,000, and I think some
right,
of these assessments are over.
There were at least several of the petitioners here that had less than $50,000, right?
I think it was one or two.
Right.
Right.
Okay, so for the people that had less than $50,000, the 237.42 says that any person may appeal from the assessment in the matter and within the time and in all other respects as provided in the case of income tax appeals by Section 235.114. So why wouldn't the waiver provision of C apply, be a part of all other respects?
It could be interpreted, I understand your point. It's my position, though, that in the first line of subsection C, we are dealing with appealing from assessment of income taxes, but I concede the point. It definitely does leave open this possibility of wider application, and frankly, that would be beneficial for many taxpayers. I think in this case, though, going back to the facts of this case, because it's consolidated, we are dealing with kind of a mixed bag here. Some meet the threshold, some don't. But I would agree it is an interpretation that can be made. I cite subsection C to assist the court in understanding the language of subsection A.
Counsel, sounds like your argument really hinges on the court embracing your argument that appeal is ambiguous.
Yes.
That's the threshold question for the court?
I would believe so, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Are you saying that appeal is ambiguous or decision is ambiguous?
I think the word decision is less ambiguous than the word appeal. And I don't mean to speak in riddles or anything like that, but I will say that a decision is an act that is done by another court or entity.
So you are conceding that a decision that the tax appeals court lacks jurisdiction is a decision?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, but you're saying it's a decision on the merits?
I am not.
In order to constitute an appeal? That would be your first appeal completed.
The first,
if it's a decision on the merits itself.
Yes. Okay. And so it is a little odd to think of it this way, but based on that reading, there has never been a first appeal in any of these cases because it was dismissed. And there may never be if the ICA were to make the ruling that, yes, the tax appeal court has correctly found that the appeal was not perfected. There will never be a first appeal.
I understand your position.
Okay.
Thank you.
The other aspect as to why we believe the language first appeal should mean an actual on the merits review is because of this doctrine or this policy that the court has had for a very long time that predates statehood itself, this idea that we should be hearing cases on the merits. What we attempted to do is link that to access to justice and to other things that we all value, that this is that courts are a place where we can have these things heard. That policy animates the way we interpret rules. It animates how we interpret statutes, and we submit that it is something that should be considered here as well. If we are dealing with an ambiguous term, we can look to the legislative history, we can look at the structure, but we can also look at this policy we have of wanting to hear cases on their merits. So our position for reading the statute this way really does stand on those three separate bases: the structure of the statute, from what we can glean of the legislative history and the intent of the legislature by striking this balance, and finally, the judiciary's policy. Just a word about the policy is that, you know, this statute does go against the policy by requiring payment on a subsequent appeal, and so it should be construed narrowly, because again, it does go against this longstanding policy of the judiciary.
Well, counsel, I mean, our first and primary job is to faithfully interpret the statutes that are adopted by the legislature, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, our policy shouldn't outweigh that.
I raise the policy, yes, you are right, and I raise the policy because I do believe, as Justice Devens asked, these words are subject to multiple meanings, and once we go down that road, we can look to things beyond the language of the statute, and one of the things that we submit that the court can look to would be policy. This court has relied on that policy before when interpreting statutes and rules, and it can be done again.
So, go ahead.
Sorry. No, you continue, please.
Okay. So I want to make sure I understand your argument. I thought I heard you say decision encompasses a ruling of no jurisdiction.
The word decision can include that, yes.
Okay. So your argument focuses, the crux of it is the language, the first appeal in 235.114a.
Yes.
Correct. Okay. But that language says the first appeal to either the tax board or to the tax appeal court may be made without payment of the tax assessed. I'm looking through here. Am I missing it? I don't know if the word first appeal is anywhere else in this statute. So I thought your argument was the decision was ambiguous, that a decision meant on the merits. You see what I'm saying? So correct me if I'm wrong. Point out why what I just said.
Sure.
Does it make sense to you?
So you're absolutely right, Justice Ginoza. I am zeroing in on the third sentence of subsection A. The words first appeal is describing appeal in the form of a noun.
To the tax board or to the tax appeal court.
Correct. And it is our position that those words are subject to two meanings and that it should be interpreted as the act of appellate review on the merits. Now, I understand the word decision can encompass things like a dismissal order is a decision by the tax appeal court. But the word decision here really does relate back to the type of appeal. And so the way we propose it should be read is that first appeal is the act of appellate review on the merits by the tax appeal court can be made without the tax being assessed.
So now I'm hearing you say perhaps that a decision of by the tax appeal court that it lacks jurisdiction is not necessarily a decision.
It is a decision, but it is not a decision based on a review of the merits, which we believe is what first appeal is meant to cover.
Okay.
Turning back to your access to justice argument, I mean, counsel, it wasn't you, but they had counsel, you know, throughout the stage of the litigation. You know, they missed the filing deadline. They failed to properly serve the director. I know you dispute that, but that's what the court found. Didn't pay the assessment, you know, to appeal to the ICA. I mean, it seems like me that these are more, I guess, inabilities to follow the statutory obligations as opposed to barriers to justice. And it also seems to me that when we look at access to justice principles, it does carry some weight when somebody is represented versus a self-represented litigant. So can you respond to those remarks?
Certainly. The record also shows, through the filings of the taxpayers, very long, very detailed correspondence between the taxpayer and the Department of Taxation in an attempt, we believe, an attempt to try to perfect it and to try to make this work with this back and forth with these emails and the letters. And I know we're not here to get into that. However, the idea of representation is a factor. It is important. And I'm not here to necessarily make a comment about, you know, trial counsel or counsel below, what that relationship was like. I'm here on the appeal. But I think on this record, you do have an attempt by the taxpayers acting without counsel, having this back and forth discussion with the Department of Taxation. It is unusual to have that with someone who does seem to have counsel, and what that role is not really fleshed out on this record. So it is our position, though, that even when we are turning to the policy, for all intents and purposes on this record, it does look like you have the taxpayer that's really trying to do this on their own. I see I have cut into my rebuttal time, so.
All right.
I will
welcome much.
Questions later. Thank you.
Mr. Dunford.
Thank you. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Michael Dunford for Appellee Director of Taxation. Under Section 235-114A of the Hawaii Revised Statutes, a taxpayer who does not prevail may appeal from the tax appeal court to the Intermediate Court of Appeals, provided that the taxpayer shall pay the tax assessed plus statutory interest. In these four consolidated cases, the taxpayers appealed from the tax appeal court to the intermediate court without paying the assessed tax, and the intermediate court of appeals properly dismissed the appeals for lack of jurisdiction. This decision should be affirmed for three reasons. First, the statute expressly states that appeals of decisions of the tax appeal court to the ICA require payment of the assessed tax. The reading proposed by appellants would read that out of the statute for a subset of decisions of the tax appeal court, as decision has previously been defined by this court in the Alford case. Second, and in contrast, the application of the payment requirement to jurisdictional dismissals does not read the waiver provisions of 235.114c out of the statute. The tax appeal court unambiguously has the ability to grant a post-judgment motion for waiver under 114c, both under the rules of the tax appeal court and under applicable statutes. Finally, the right to appeal is granted by statute. HRS 235.114 is, as this court recognized in Kincaid versus Board, the expression of the legislature's efforts to strike the best practicable balance between the needs of the public fisc and the taxpayer's interest in a fair assessment.
You know, this, one of the things, Mr. Dunford, is that the statute doesn't say when the taxes must be paid for purposes of an appeal to the ICA. Is it possible for it to be paid after the notice of appeal is filed with the ICA?
That it is true that there's not a time statement on there. Our position is that because the language of the statute says shall pay the tax assessed, it's a mandatory requirement that is part of the appeals process, similar to the filing of the notice of appeal.
So you like the ICA, you view it as a jurisdiction, like a requirement of jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor.
Of the ICA. I mean, you know, for appeals filed in the appellate courts, there are fees. And when parties don't pay the fees, the ICA would issue an order to show cause, for instance, give the parties an opportunity to pay those fees and then act accordingly. Why wouldn't that be an appropriate procedure here?
It's not the procedure that the court in the Lewis versus Kawafuchi case, or I believe a couple of other cases, there's another unpublished from the Intermediate Court of Appeals in Reed Johnson. In both of those cases, it's been applied as a jurisdictional requirement rather than as something along the lines of a show cause order or similar.
I mean, Jessica knows is right. There's nothing in the statute that says, I mean, it's silent, that you have to pay the assessments plus interest, which can be a considerable amount of money, a lot more than a court filing fee. And there's nothing in the statute that says that. So let's say the taxpayer timely files a notice of appeal to the ICA, but one day later, then it pays the tax assessment and interest. And what your position is the court lacks jurisdiction. The case gets dismissed. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor, although the taxpayer would not necessarily be out of options at that point, particularly if we're in a position where there was a jurisdictional dismissal below. There are two separate sets of procedures for appealing in a tax appeal situation, one of which is payment under protest under HRS 40-35. So in a case such as this one, where there was a lack of jurisdiction below, such that there was in effect potentially no appeal at all, there is that second avenue that would remain open, which would be contingent on the same payment effectively.
What's the timing on when they can do that? Pay the taxes under protest and then challenge up?
To the best of my knowledge, Your Honor, there is not a fixed timeline for that one.
Okay.
That's been identified also in the department, in the Taxpayer Bill of Rights and other department positions.
In the protest, so the ICA then, you're one day late, dismisses the case, there's jurisdiction. Then you have your protest, and what, somehow the case then materializes back up to the ICA? I'm not understanding that.
It would be a fresh case at that point, Your Honor. And there, it is possible that there are also situations such as an appeal that has gone all the way through the merits at the tax appeal court where that wouldn't be available because they've already exhausted that option. But our position is that it would remain a jurisdictional requirement, the same as if they had filed the notice of appeal a day late. On the,
let me ask you this too. It's sort of along these lines, but is it is there really a difference between sort of this statutory obligation and its fees? It's almost fees, but it's a kind of a super fee, you know, in addition to, you know, their normal rules of appellate procedure that we have and filing fees and all that. You know, that's a statutory obligation, but what you're really talking about is a jurisdictional bar. And when it comes to jurisdiction, that's a big, big deal. And as Mr. Lowenthal points out, you know, there are significant access to justice issues with just shutting a person out of the court like that. So relating that all back to the statutory, you know, interpretation, doesn't decision really mean a decision and not just a dismissal?
As this court has interpreted this statute in the past, Your Honor, and in fact drawing somewhat from the Tax Foundation amicus in this case, the Tax Foundation suggests that the court interpret decision in a manner that's consistent with both Alford versus City and County and the ICA decision in Lewis versus Kawafuchi. In this case, both of those definitions would be met. The Alford says a decision that finally decides all issues in the tax appeal. Lewis says the final decision should be clearly ascertainable. Ellis versus Crockett, which is at, I believe, 51 Hawaii 45, 1969 case, was cited in Lewis versus Kawafuchi, I believe, for this point, and says that an order dismissing a case in full is a judgment that denies all relief to the party whose case has been dismissed.
You know, I just was looking at the Alford language, and Alford says this: this court said that an appealable decision should be one that finally decides all issues in the tax appeal. So how is it finally deciding all issues in the tax appeal when a case just gets kneecapped through jurisdictional issues?
In the same way, Your Honor, that a jurisdictional dismissal would in effect decide any other civil case. If there is a lack of jurisdiction, there is no ability for the court to reach the issues.
So what if this court were to, I'm not saying that this would happen, but what if this court were to disagree with the ICA and say that, rule that there was jurisdiction, that the tax appeal court, that the ICA did have jurisdiction?
Presumably the ICA would then go on to assess whether or not the tax appeal court's decision that it lacked jurisdiction, which was on entirely different grounds, should stand, in which case there's a good chance we would be back here relatively soon.
What if this court were to rule that, untimely or deficient notice to the tax director is not a jurisdictional issue, and at least for some of the taxpayers, jurisdiction does exist, and therefore it goes back to the tax appeal court. Is that then still a first appeal?
Based on the language of the statute, we would say that effectively it is not, in that the purpose of the words first appeal in that statute appear to be primarily designed to ensure that you don't get two trips to the tax appeal court for free, because the tax appeal court does serve in effect as a court of appeal of Board of Review decisions. So in the context of the statute and in the context of the legislative history with what the legislature was trying to do there, they were extending the free bite at the apple that had already been granted to Board of Review decisions, to first appeals to the Tax Appeal Court in an effort to reduce the load on the Board of Review. But they also were expressly maintaining that the payment of the assessment requirement would apply to appeals from the board to the Tax Appeal Court. So our position is that the first appeal language here is largely intended to make sure that that distinction remains clear rather than as a reference to a sequence of events, the pure sequence of events. Philosophically, there is that always that open question, I guess, of whether or not a case that has gone all the way up on appeal and gone all the way back down on appeal remains of the same case that it started at. But there also, I would point to the language that says to go from the Tax Appeal Court to the ICA requires payment. That's also supported, I think, by the Senate Committee report, particularly 1366, which expressly stated that appeals by the taxpayer after a judgment against the taxpayer at the Tax Appeal Court should be permitted only after paying the outstanding tax assessment, which would appear to indicate that the legislature saw going up at that point to be a second appeal in effect or a subsequent appeal rather than a new, fresh start. Turning to the AC conflict that's come up a couple of times, one point that I think is worth noting here is that in the reply brief, it was asserted that Rule 60 would not apply in the Tax Appeal Court, and or that the Tax Appeal Court would lack the ability to issue judgments in support of its jurisdiction or collateral judgments. That's incorrect both on the rules and on the statutes. It's true that there is no Rule 60 in the rules of the Tax Appeal Court and no equivalent to Rule 60 in those rules. However, Rule 1B of the rules of the Tax Appeal Court states that in a situation where there is no direct analog, the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure apply, followed by the rules of the circuit courts in that order. Even if that was not sufficient, HRS 232.12 grants the Tax Appeal Court all the powers and authority of a circuit court when carrying out its duties and functions, and HRS 603-21.9 sub 6 grants the circuit courts the power to do such other acts and takes such other steps as may be necessary to carry into effect the full power, the powers that have been granted to it by the legislature, which would include, logically, the ability to rule on a C motion for waiver. And similarly, 21.91 provides the circuit courts with the power to issue all orders and writs in aid of their jurisdiction.
Does the ICA have similar powers when appeals come to it?
I believe that's under 602, but I don't have the references in front of me. Yes.
ICA has pretty extensive power to do what's just also, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And there's at least one statute that talks about the appeal is taken per the court rules, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so then would the court rules that allow for filing a supersedious bond also apply?
In the Tax Appeal Court?
Yes.
I believe so, Your Honor, yes.
And how could that be done without a court order while before the appeal is filed if it's jurisdictional to pay the tax? In other words, doesn't the ICA have to set the amount of the bond and how the bond is to be structured? They can't do it without the ICA actually hearing the case, taking the case. It's not something that the appellate can do right away, right? I mean, they have to say, we propose to file a supersedious bond in this amount and under this type of bond, right? And the ICA has to approve it. So yes. Then why is the payment of the tax jurisdictional?
In part, it's because I believe there's a policy decision that's come up repeatedly over the years to ensure, in effect, a balance of fairness. On the one hand, we have the taxpayer and the taxpayer's interests in receiving the hearing from the courts on their amounts. On the other side, and this is something that I was looking at recently, the New Jersey Supreme Court has talked about in City of Philadelphia versus Austin, which was 86 New Jersey 55 at 65, pointing out that when one taxpayer fails to bear his or her fair share, the burden becomes heavier on other taxpayers. Tax evasion does not reduce the cost of government, it merely shifts it to others. In the case of delinquent taxes, it's an unfortunate truth that frequently people who owe sums of money in back taxes often have significant other debts, and there is a substantial risk of insolvency along the way. The removal of the initial pay-to-play requirement provides an opportunity for hearing while requiring the payment of the assessed tax to move on to the next step of appeal, with that payment going to the litigated funds, the litigated claims fund, in effect ensures that if the state prevails, it will be able to recover and the taxpayers will not bear the burden of a taxpayer becoming insolvent during the lengthy pendency, potentially, of an appeals process. So it's a balancing act, and in effect, what the legislature has said is that instead of making this a bond situation, we're going to go ahead and set it as the taxes due will be paid into the litigated claims fund and held until the completion of appeals.
You know, when we talk about going back to jurisdiction, and when we talk about jurisdiction, we usually, you know, there we have rules, many, many rules, many statutes that talk about time frame. And this particular statute that we're discussing today has a time frame in C, and it says 30 days to do a notice of appeal. And that is a jurisdictional precept, principle. But A doesn't have that. And I guess, why should we construe the statute the way you want us to construe it to mean that while the legislature says a 30-day notice of appeal for the original first appeal, and then there's nothing else after that, and it gets me thinking too that, you know, you could have like a case getting kicked for a clerical defect the day after it's filed on the first appeal. You could get a case that maybe the court clerk or the court itself loses a file, then dismisses a case for failure to prosecute. And then there was really no true decision. It just doesn't seem jurisdictional to me in the sense that we're talking about money to advance your case on the merits.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand. In this case, I think I'm going to go back to the tax appeal of Lower Mapunapuna, which is one of the cases where this court has said that the right of appeal is purely statutory and it's limited as provided by the legislature, and compliance with the method and procedure prescribed by it is obligatory. In this regard, the legislature elected to prescribe payment of the assessed tax as a condition for the appeal. So, This has been treated as jurisdictional, as I said, at least by the intermediate court in other cases
Yes, Your
Honor. Is it really jurisdictional, or is it really just the method and procedure for taking an appeal versus jurisdiction itself, like the deadline?
I'm not...
It seemed like Lower Mapunapuna addressed the methods and procedures, and that's sort of, I think, what your position is. But it just doesn't seem like a payment obligation is jurisdictional. We've talked about court fees, for example, and those being excused at times when we get motions for, informa pauperis, quite frequently, as a matter of fact. And the fact that those come in later doesn't cause the court to, kick the case. So I'm just wondering if Lower Mapunapuna is saying what you're suggesting it was saying, or if it's just simply methods and procedures for taking the appeal.
I think, based on the legislative history and the Senate reports, Your Honor, that the legislature, one of their primary intents here was ensuring that there weren't going to be substantial delays, in effect, that they were looking to make sure that this process was moving fairly quickly. So in that regard, an interpretation, I think, that in effect extends out the time that a taxpayer would have to make that payment and perfect the appeal for an indefinite period would interfere with that legislative intent, at least to an extent. And it does, again, the language of the Senate report there does indicate that they did at least intend for that payment to be required in order for an appeal to proceed in the intermediate court.
Does 232.19 apply at all here? Appeals procedure, taxpayer aggrieved may appeal to the ICA subject to Chapter 602 from the decision of the tax appeal court?
Yes, Your Honor.
By filing a written notice of appeal?
Yes, Your
Honor.
And
depositing the costs of the appeal in the matter required by court rules within 30 days, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And, as Justice Ginoza has indicated, when appeals are filed at the ICA, or Justice Edens has also alluded to this, that the courts do sometimes waive costs, right? And you've already indicated that the court rules do apply. Court rules allow for the filing of a supersedious bond. So do you see there seems to be some tension between 235.114 and 232-19? There's a little bit of confusion or ambiguity caused by these two statutes. And which applies under what circumstances?
Yes,
because it seems like under 232.19, the ICA would be able to order a bond, or would be even be able to waive costs if it chose to do so. We're not always dealing with GET amounts that exceed $50,000. I mean, we need to think about how this decision is going to impact all taxpayers that might be appealing GET, right? And to say that unless they pay the full amount, after the tax appeals court says that they don't have jurisdiction because they didn't serve the director properly, they have to pay on the jurisdictional issue. Does that sound like that's something that's fair?
And, Your Honor, I think that's why the waiver provisions in C are there. The waiver provisions in C are there expressly to provide the opportunity where that debt, whether it's GE or income
or
otherwise.
So you're indicating that once the tax appeals court says you didn't serve the director properly, so this court doesn't have jurisdiction, this court doesn't have jurisdiction, but the court still has jurisdiction to allow a waiver of the payment of the GET for that issue, for the issue, jurisdictional issue, to be taken up on appeal?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that would clearly fall under the 603.21.96 ability to issue the orders that are necessary or required to carry out the powers that the court has been given. And the legislature has very expressly given the tax appeal court the power to issue those waivers. And then again, if even if that did not apply, I think the all writs necessary to aid in its jurisdiction under 21.91 would apply. I think there's a lot of different ways to get to the tax appeal court would, even in a jurisdictional dismissal, absolutely have the ability to go ahead and issue a waiver under C.
Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no further questions.
All right, thank you
thank
very
you,
much, Mr. Dunford. Rebuttal, Mr. Lowenthal.
I wish to return to the discussion that we've been having about jurisdiction, and in preparing for this case, spent a lot of time thinking about jurisdiction, and I tend to think of jurisdiction as the court's power to do something. Jurisdiction is power. And that's why in our petition, we cite a very old case from the 1860s, bears repeating. Once the court determines there's no jurisdiction, quote, the only remaining function to the court is that of announcing the fact and dismissing the case. So once a court declares there is truly no jurisdiction to proceed, all that's left to do is dismiss. And that's what the problem is with this tension between A and C. Now, I understand that today, the department is saying, well, you can ask for the waiver pursuant to these other statutes or incorporating these other rules. But again, it's not really addressing this issue as to what is, whether the court can truly do these things once they have declared no jurisdiction and dismissed the case, leaving nothing left to do. Which again, that tension, as Justice McKenna raises, is still there. And even if there is a waiver under subsection C, we are dealing with a very narrow class of taxpayers, GE taxes, whether it's just GE or not, income taxes, whether it's just income taxes or not, I know it was raised earlier today, but it seems to suggest it would only be for income taxes and under a certain threshold. That still leaves a vast number of taxpayers who would have this jurisdictional bar if it is treated, in fact, as something of jurisdiction. There are things that need to be done in addition to jurisdiction that may not necessarily be let me try that again. Justice Edens did point out this distinction between steps that perfect jurisdiction as opposed to things that simply must be done in order to proceed in the appellate court. What comes to mind for me would be, yes, filing fees, but also the CADs in a civil case. We all know that it is required under the rules, that you have to file it, that there are penalties for not filing it, but we all agree that's not necessarily jurisdictional. So there are things in our rules that require the appellant to do something that aren't necessarily jurisdictional. The questions today do seem to reflect kind of a stepping back at this statute to determine, is this really something that is jurisdictional? And if it isn't, is there a way around it? And I would submit that is exactly why we have these policies of hearing cases on the merits, and why we want these cases to be heard on the merits. And it behooves this court to be mindful of the policy when interpreting this statute. It all fits, in our view, rather nicely. I'm almost running out of time, so unless there are any questions, I do have a brief summation.
Does not appear to be any more questions. So
mahalo.
E ka paona ka aha ho kolokolo ina mea pini I ke ia hihia. This court will take this matter under advisement.
E ku iluna, please rise. Ua ho o ku u ia mai ne kea aha ho o kolokolo ki I ke hanahano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.